generation after generation so that this old and unique art remains eternal. This documentary is a tribute to our beloved country, Iran. Iran is a country full of wealth in so many ways, tens of generations before us, and we use the same Iranian dishes, and it is up to us to protect the sacred heritage. I'm Nusha Tabibi Gilani. I'm interested in Iranian culture and food. In the previous episode, I talked about the Caspian Sea and its beautiful city Anzali and Gilan region. We saw a beautiful Anzali Lagoon and talked about the problems it faces. We said that we have to protect this God-given wealth very well. We looked at the history of this region and listened to the bitter story of foreign intervention in this area. We visited the fish market and ate together with our beloved friends. I explained about the process which is taken in the smokehouses. We learned about the Caspian sturgeon fish and its species, and then we ate dinner together with the Abbasian family. Then we moved towards the Persian Gulf. The sea provides Iran access to the world's open waters and oceans. The longest coastline of Iran is located here, which stretches from the southwest and southeast. Oil resources and the Khuzestan Plain are located above this coastline in the west. The biological and ethnic diversity of this region is an irreplaceable wealth for the country. Different Iranian ethnic groups complete a unique picture of our national culture, each with a special color, taste, and scent. The lives of the inhabitants of the northern lands of the Persian Gulf are tied to this waterway. The material and spiritual life of all Iranians has a strong relationship with the spirit of this Gulf. The Persian Gulf is 900 kilometers long and about 240 kilometers wide and has a total area of 223,000 square kilometers. After the Gulf of Mexico and the Hudson Bay, it is the third largest gulf in the world. Thousands of people earn their livelihoods from the Persian Gulf, and food for millions of people is supplied from this sea. The material and spiritual importance of the Persian Gulf has caused enemies and rivals to infringe upon this Iranian wealth time and again with the empty will of destroying the pillars of our beloved homeland. Sometimes the enemies produce name, purple name, and other times they try to switch military. The history of forged the name of the Persian Gulf to about 6 years ago. Some enemies try to change a historical and geographical concept to advance their own political goals. Others of this Gulf were in vain, and they will not reach their goals in the future. This geographical historical fact forms a part of our national identity of our neighbors, Gulf, and can be changed. According to international legal laws, the name of a geographical unit that is outside the national borders of a country cannot be changed in any way. Our historical neighbors in the south, northwest, and west coast of the Persian Gulf are our historical and religious brothers and sisters. Our lives have been intertwined for many centuries. People with similar faces, common lifestyles, and same foods have been living between the shores of the Persian Gulf for thousands of years. The Karun River runs from the north of Khuzestan province to the coast of the Persian Gulf and gives life on its way. Two kind Ahvazi fishermen invited me to observe the river and become aware of the situation of fishing. I went on their boat and tried not to disturb their daily work. I saw and heard that many people in this region come to the river with the simplest facilities to catch fish. This method has been used for thousands of years and has not harmed the fish in this river. A few fish, a lot of trash, come out with each net. Those few fish are the gains of the fishermen. Fishing is a job, and fishermen go through much suffering in the Karun River. In Ahvaz and Abadan is intertwined with sea, fish, fishing, dates, coffee, and football. The fish markets are considered the heart of these cities. The Abadan Fish Market is a place where citizens and fishmongers visit on a daily basis for life and vibrancy. A variety of aquatic animals live in this southern sea. The sandy and rocky coast of Sistan, Tasistan, and Baluchistan forms an area of 1,500 kilometers. Each part has its own fish and shrimp. The sea has provided food for these people for thousands of years. The sea is their way of communication with the people of other lands and has made them accept immigrants and establish ties with their neighbors. The main food of the people of these beaches is fish and other seafood. The people of Kish Island have a proverb that says, "We never get tired of eating fish." Of course, this habit depends on the climate and character of the people of each region, and people who live in other cities of Iran tend to eat few fish. It is not only the sea, Karun and Dez rivers, that people get their sustenance from. This is a Shadgan International Wetland. The wetland is located near the city of Shadgan in Khuzestan. The water in this wetland is salty and sweet due to its proximity to the sea. Fishing is common here, and there are local fish markets on the outskirts. The types of fish that can be found in this wetland, as the local people call them, are barzum, shirbut, rashti, and shotgun trout, which only has the name of trout, because it is different from the trout found in the northern areas in every way. A food vendor prepares grilled fish with hashu for the visitors on the side of the wetland in the Sarakhiye village. Majid and his son have a very small place. In the same place, they prepare food and coffee in a traditional way for the visitors. Sarakhiye village is really beautiful, and we can observe native and old Iranian Arabic traditions there. We can eat their traditional food and see the magnificent Shadhan wetland. Majid's image is tied to our very fond memories of the wetland and Sarakhiye village and tasty and cheap food. Fishing is common in all other branches of Dez and Karun rivers and small local rivers and streams. Here is Bahrigan. It has the longest pier in Iran. In this area, many fishermen from afar and near cities and villages catch fish. In Shia jurisprudence, it is permissible and halal to eat only scaly fish and shrimp, and it is forbidden to eat anything else in the sea. But the Sunnis do not have a prohibition against eating aquatic animals. For this reason, it is common for them to eat oysters, crabs, squid, and other sea creatures. The fishing of squid, crabs, and other aquatic animals continues, and various companies in the south of the country are busy packing and exporting them while they do not have buyers in the Shia areas of Iran. Eating shrimp in restaurants in big cities was not in line with local and southern style from the beginning. In fact, people in the big cities of Iran have not learned to eat shrimp from their southern compatriots. The shrimp was cooked in a foreign shape and puffy. The shrimps were dipped in a kind of paste and then cooked in oil. Today it is called puffed shrimp, and a while back it was called fried shrimp. For many years, shrimps were sold in frozen packages with the logo of Iran Fisheries Company on them. Fresh shrimp was not usually available. The main shrimp customers were expensive restaurants. Shrimp fishing was very prosperous in the Persian Gulf and Sea of Oman. But the catch of marine species or wild shrimp is no longer according to the previous volume. Among the reasons are trawl fishing by foreign and Iranian boats and water pollution. Fishing shrimp, fish, and other aquatic animals, as well as traveling between the northern and southern coasts of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, were carried out with vessels that moved with the power of the wind and were called jahaz. With technical advances, installing diesel and gasoline engines on them, sails were removed. They call them launch since the 1950s, when these changes took place. There has been a lot of indigenous technology and the use of natural materials in the construction of the launch. Some of these wooden launches would function for about 100 years. The launches should be brought from the sea to the shore every few months to clean the moss attached to it and then apply oil to its wood. Moss sticking to the launches makes it difficult to move and disturbs floating balance. Launches have different kinds and have different names depending on their function and appearance. Some of these launches are used for cargo, others for transferring passengers, and some of them for fishing. Here are some types of launches and their names. Sambuk, which is a Persian word that means sharp. Samaj is the same small sambuk and it is used in fishing. Bati is another type of fishing boat which is not used any longer. Shui, kuchi, and boom are among other types of launches. Launches not only carried goods, and the two-way culture of the waterway has come closer to each other with these vessels. The families of brides and grooms visited each other from both sides of the Persian Gulf and formed families. Today, foreigners have come from the other side of the world and are causing differences between the old tribes. We have been neighbors for hundreds of years, and we're so similar to one another that if we go to a traditional house in Umalkevin or Sharjah, it is like stepping into a house in Kong, Qishm, Laft, or Bushehr without any difference. The livelihood of many people depended and still depends on these launches. Of course, many of these launches have stopped moving and have fallen into a corner and have been abandoned on the banks of rivers and seas for various reasons. These old and abandoned boats were responsible for the trade of this region, and thousands of people made a living from them. This is a cemetery of launches. Despite their epic image, they elicit a sad feeling. These boats were once the privileged vessels of the Persian Gulf and traveled east, west, north, and south to the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea. Iranian sailors are used to these boats and made a living with them for centuries until today that these vessels are now deformed. But today the sailors stick to the old ways of working. Seafaring and fishing are precise and calculated work, the rules of which must strictly be implemented. Relationships in launches, fishing, boats, and other related issues can be based on kindness. There should be strict rules so that people can carry out their responsibilities. These people take their sustenance from the sea with difficulty and many problems, which is sometimes very dangerous.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
To understand why the United States regime is caught in a vicious circle of violence, it helps to look at a number of Only in America statistics and explain the easy legal way to get a gun in a country that accounts for less than 5% of the world's population and 46% of global civilian gun ownership. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. WeOwned reported, first, a little known but a startling statistic. There are around 78,000 federally licensed gun dealers in the U.S. That is more than all McDonald's, Burger King, and Subway's combined, according to a recent count by Everytown for Gun Safety, an advocacy network founded a decade ago by former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Since the beginning of the year, those dealers sold an estimated average of 42,000 guns a day, and the rush for guns shows no signs of abating. That number is extrapolated from the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, NICS, which was created in the wake of an unsuccessful 1981 attempt to assassinate then-President Ronald Reagan. His press secretary, James Brady, was permanently disabled by a gunshot wound in the attack. Brady died in 1974. His wife, Sarah, founded the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, which keeps track of firearm sales on the basis of NICS firearms transaction records, a short-form prospective gun buyers need to complete to buy a firearm. The form is emailed by the dealer to the FBI, which responds within minutes, reflecting the instant in NICS. The Brady Campaign filters out categories on the forms that are not directly related to sales, and its estimates tend to be more conservative than those of other groups that equate NICS checks with sales. But there is consensus that over the years, the number of firearms in civilian hands has grown relentlessly and now far exceeds the population of 333.2 million. While the American arsenal grew by millions in the first 6 months of the year, the death toll from firearms ran around 125 a day, roughly the average over the past few years. There were more suicides than murders. Mass shootings, defined by the Gun Violence Archive, as at least four people killed or wounded, totaled 333 halfway through the year. Worth noting, the astonishing numbers estimated on the basis of NICS minimize the huge size of the arsenal. A private citizen selling a firearm to another private citizen does not need to file a transaction record. How many such private deals are made is not known, which is why groups advocating for better controls have been calling for universal background checks for decades. Polls show overwhelming public support for such checks, but a string of attempts to translate that into law has failed over the years, thanks largely to vigorous and well-funded efforts by lobbyists for the gun industry, most prominently the National Rifle Association, NRA. It portrays itself as the key defender of the right to own guns, enshrined in the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Through the unaccountable number of privately sold weapons, add a relatively new phenomenon, ghost guns. These are firearms assembled from kits sold online and have, in the words of every town for gun safety, become a weapon of choice for violent criminals, including white supremacists. Unlike guns produced by manufacturers, ghost guns carry no serial numbers and thus cannot be traced. Ghost guns were a niche product for do-it-yourself enthusiasts for years, but sales took off around 2009 when California state law banned the sale of semi-automatic rifles like the AR-15. Since then, sales have risen steadily, and several ghost guns have been linked to mass shootings, including one at Santa Monica College, which killed 6 students. By 2019, there were so many in circulation that authorities reported having recovered around 10,000 falling shooting incidents around the country. In Washington, plagued by a series of carjackings by armed teenagers in the past few months, ghost guns were used in many of the incidents. With so many guns in circulation, legally bought or homemade, who makes up the client base for more? Recent research indicates that the demographic of gun ownership has been changing, a development experts linked to the outbreak of the COVID pandemic and the uncertainties it injected into daily life. The National Shooting Exports Federation, the Firearms Industry's Trade Association, found that gun ownership among Black Americans jumped 56% from 2019 to 2020, the first full year of the pandemic. According to a recent preliminary study by Harvard University, a 14% increase in gun purchases by women brought female gun ownership in the country to 42%. The majority of gun owners are still white men, but now statistics indicate of diverse backgrounds. Friendly neighborhood office commuter is just as likely to carry a gun as a car mechanic. You wouldn't know because it would be talked out of sight. All 50 states allow citizens over 21 to carry a concealed handgun. In 27 states, no permit for concealed carry is required. In others, obtaining a permit is obligatory and can be difficult. Allowing citizens to carry their guns concealed without a permit has been a top priority of the firearms industry. Its leaders argue that there should be no bureaucratic hurdles to the constitutional right to guns. One side effect of greater numbers of women arming up is the growth of a fashion industry which designs clothes that make it easy to hide their guns and stay fashionable. Last year's NRA convention featured a concealed carry fashion show where models displayed guns tucked into their clothes. One website for the fashionable gun woman shows a model wearing a dress over a gun held in the dress. Another site offers a loose blouse with a decorative front knot covering a gun. Purses with a special compartments are also in demand. According to Al Jazeera English, the United States saw a record of 28 mass killings in the first half of 2023. The Associated Press has reported as policymakers struggle to curb gun violence across the country. The AP analysis published recently said 140 victims were killed during that period. all but one of the mass killings, incidents in which four or more people are slain, not including the perpetrator, involve firearms. Brent Letterwood, whose three children were in class at a private Christian school in Nashville in March, when a former student fatally shot six people, told AP, "What a ghastly milestone. You never think your family would be a part of a statistic like that." A database maintained by the Associated Press and USA Today in partnership with Northeastern University has been tracking larger-scale violence since 2006. The 2023 milestone beat the previous record of 27 mass killings, which was only set in the second half of 2022. James Allen Fox, a criminology professor at Northeastern University, never imagined records like this when he began overseeing the database about 5 years ago. Fox told AP, "We used to say there were 2 to 3 dozen a year. The fact that there is 28 in half a year is a staggering statistic."
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله. الله يا الله والحمد لله. الله ولا إله إلا الله. الله يا الله والله أكبر.
This is the short part of Imam Khomeini's speech. Do not be deceived by the presence of the superpowers in churches or by their prayers for spies and traitors. They think of nothing but more power and supremacy over the world, which is against divine teachings. Our nation suffered from this hypocrisy of the oppressors for many years, and you, the oppressed of the world, arise and unite to be rid of the oppressors, for the earth belongs to Allah and its inheritors are the oppressed.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Muharram and Ashura. In one of his speeches, he mentioned that Karbala washed away the palace of the oppressors with blood, and our Karbala destroyed the devilish palace of the monarchy. In this part of his speech, obviously, he's mentioning that the movement that Imam Khomeini had, it is in line with the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. The Karbala that was occurred in 61 Hijri, that was a battle between Imam Hussein and the oppressor of his time. And at this present time, when the revolution, Islamic revolution was happening, there was another Yazid. And he threw away that Yazid by following the footsteps of Imam Hussein. And that's why he says that our Karbala destroyed the devilish palace of the monarchy. Now, this Karbala is not only about the revolution. It's not about the struggle that people has done or made before the revolution. It even continued after the revolution. And we saw that how 8-year war was imposed on this Islamic revolution by the powers of the world, and they supported an arrogant country to destroy the Islamic revolution. But obviously, because the Islamic revolution, the role model was Karbala, because they learned lessons from Karbala, from Imam Hussein, they saved their country. They saved this revolution.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi
sallallahu alayhi.
Imam Khomeini is saying, he says that whenever a Karbala occurs, whenever there is a Karbala, it washes away the palace of oppressors. No matter these oppressors are living at which time. If there is a Karbala, even at your time, it will wash away the oppressor of your time. Therefore, remember that if you want to get rid of the arrogant powers, if you want to get rid of the oppressors, the arrogance, the oppressors, the unjust ones, the terrorists, you need to follow the footsteps of those who were in Karbala. You need to have a new Karbala. And the Karbala of Iran, which was headed by Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, it showed that with the sacrifices which they gave, they have thrown away the oppressor, the arrogant king of the time. And obviously, this devilish palace of the monarchy was destroyed with the Karbala of Iran.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
The United Nations has said the United Kingdom's controversial bill aimed at stopping thousands of migrants and refugees from arriving is at odds with the country's obligations under international law. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to WION, the United Nations has slammed the British illegal migration bill just when it got parliamentary assent on July 18th. In a sharp reaction, the UN has said that the bill, which awaits formality of the royal assent to become a law, is against London's obligations under international law. In a joint statement, the UN refugee and human rights chief said that the bill is at variance with the country's obligations under international human rights and refugee law and will have profound consequences for people in need of international protection. The controversial bill seeks to stop thousands of migrants arriving on British shores in small boats. The bill has cleared its last parliamentary hurdle. The members of the House of Lords, the unelected upper house, defeated a string of challenges to the government's illegal migration bill. The bill is central to UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's pledge to stop the boats. UN Refugees head Filippo Grandi said, "This new legislation significantly erodes the legal framework that has protected so many, exposing refugees to grave risks in breach of international law." He said, "I urge the UK government to renew this commitment to human rights by reversing this law and ensuring that the rights of all migrants, refugees and asylum seekers are respected, protected and fulfilled without discrimination." The bill, when it becomes a law, will mean that anyone arriving by boat will be denied the right to apply for asylum in the UK. As the Parliament has passed the bill, it will now await the formality of the royal assent from King Charles. The legislation provides for measures which are seen as a deterrent to migrants. The bill says that all irregular arrivals may be transferred to safe third countries such as Rwanda. This means that a migrant who may not be from Rwanda can potentially be transferred there. In 2022, more than 45,000 migrants arrived on the shores of Southeast England in small boats. This was a 60% annual increase in the influx of migrants. The sea route is perilous and has been used by more people since 2018. Recently, three Court of Appeal judges in the UK ruled that Rwanda cannot be considered a safe third country. The UK government said last month that it would appeal the judgment. Prime Minister Sunak has said he respects the court but fundamentally disagrees with the conclusions drawn by the judges. Till now, no deportation flights to Rwanda have taken place. Rights groups accuse Rwanda ruled with an iron fist by President Paul Kagame since the end of 1994 genocide that killed around 800,000 people of cracking down on free speech and opposition. According to France 24, Britain's controversial plan to deter migrants without papers from landing on British shores was poised to become law, prompting criticism from the United Nations. The legislation would outlaw asylum claims by all arrivals via the Channel and other illegal routes and transfer them to third countries such as Rwanda. It was proposed in response to years of growing numbers of dangerous cross-channel journeys from northern France in small boats. Opposition to the bill was finally crushed at late night, sitting just hours before a barge that will be used to house migrants arrived at a port on England's south coast. The BB Stockholm barge moored in Dorset's Portland port is expected to house 500 asylum seekers from later this month. The UN Refugee Agency condemned the passage of the government's illegal migration bill as a breach of international law and warned it would expose refugees to grave risks. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi said, "This new legislation significantly erodes the legal framework that has protected so many."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, and welcome to Africa Today, a show that keeps you updated on events taking place across Africa. From the ever-changing political landscape, the evolving social scene, innovation and technology, to the race for massive natural resources, we bring you the continent closer to you. My name is Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. In today's episode, we are focusing on the recent referendum in Mali that ushered in a new constitution that will pave way towards a transition to civilian rule. The second segment of our program today is on the expanding relations between Iran and Burkina Faso, a West African country keen to revive the thoughts of its revolutionary and charismatic leader, Thomas Sankara.
Mali's new constitution. The people of Mali approved changes to the constitution in a recent referendum that the military rulers and regional powers have said will pave the way to elections and a return to civilian rule. The West African country's electoral authority said that 97% of votes were cast in favor of the changes during the June 18th referendum. The referendum is a major milestone on the road to elections promised for February 2024, after a coup in May 2021.
Speaking after casting his vote, Mali's interim president Assimi Goïta said that the new constitution provides for a better organized executive power while maintaining the necessary balance with the legislative power. Let's take a listen.
I am convinced that the referendum will pave the way for a new Mali, a strong and efficient Mali serving the well-being of our people. And I would also like to launch an appeal to all Malians, whatever the outcome of the referendum results, to hold hands and form a sacred union around Mali.
Now, for more on Mali's new constitution approved during the recent referendum, we have contacted Kix Shodex. She's a security analyst based in Lagos. Thanks a lot for your time, madam.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak on this very important topic.
Now, first, can you tell us more about the significance of Mali's new referendum that was overwhelmingly approved by voters during the June referendum?
When it comes to this question of referendums, we can say that Mali generally has referendums. I remember the former president, before the coup occurred, he had a referendum on making sure that the French allies left the country. And the people voted unanimously on that. And so I don't think this is any different, because the people always were happy when the military took over. You know, there were protests. So we didn't expect anything lesser than they agreeing to the referendum, as long as it means that they will not be having French forces or any kind of foreign forces that they do not agree to be in their space.
Mustafa Cisse, the head of the Electoral Commission, said the turnout for the referendum was at 39.4% in the country of 8.4 million registered voters. Many Malians have expressed optimism that chronic instability that kept many voters away will end with the new constitution.
Democracy since the Third Republic has not really worked. This vote, I believe, will help to bring back stability to the country.
Some of the proposed clauses in the new constitution drafted by the Transitional Council are contentious, with proponents saying they would strengthen fragile political institutions and opponents saying the changes will enable the military to stay in power beyond elections next year.
For me, my take on this matter is I've been against the occupation of the military from the start, because it doesn't change anything. If there is a new constitution that states that the military can stay for as long as it wants and the military can decide on how things will be run in the country, for me, that does not work, right? And for the people, eventually, they would realize that that does not work. This is not the first time we'll be having military occupation in the country. Prior to this military coup, Mali is one of those countries that have successively had coups. And so the opponent are very correct in their assertion on what is going to happen in the future.
The referendum is the first in a series of events meant to pave the way for presidential elections in February 2024. Mali's military leaders have committed to hold the elections on time, and many voters say they are ready to vote for the current interim president, Assimi Goïta, if he runs in next year's polls.
I say yes to Assimi Goïta, our next president.
I love our country and I love the armed forces. I think they're doing a good job.
We want a new constitution for young people in Mali. It will bring peace, prosperity and stability.
The referendum itself is seen by international observers as an important test of the military government's willingness to stick to the transition and hold a nationwide democratic process. Now, are you optimistic that this referendum has put Mali on the right path of returning to full civilian rule?
If you follow the incident from the beginning, from when it started, right, it was clear that the military was not open to any sort of transition. They were strong-armed by ECOWAS to go into or to decide on some sort of timeline for that transition because of the hard line that the ECOWAS took against Mali. Nevertheless, this is going to show that this was not their plan from the start. So if the people are in agreement for the military to stay for however long they want, it is not certain that the military will try to come back to that space where civilian rule will be accepted.
French troops left Mali last year after being expelled by Bamako following 9 years of the so-called War on Terror, which left Mali one of the poorest countries in the world while failing to defeat terrorism. Many Malians believe that uranium deposits, which keep French nuclear power cheap, gold mines, and the desire to maintain the neocolonial system known as Françafrique, were the primary motivations for French military presence in the country, and that the war on terror was just a pretext.
Ils ne sont pas contre la France, ils ne sont pas contre les Français, mais oui, ils sont contre la politique française au Mali, ils sont contre la politique française au Sahel. Les choses ont changé. Nous pensons que la France maintient le statu quo pour qu'elle reste maître de lieu.
Now, given the expanded role of the military in Mali's new constitution and the ejection of French forces accused of backing terrorists and insurgents in this country, do you foresee stability being restored in this West African nation?
Yeah, for the fact that the French forces that were in collaboration with the civilian government are leaving is not an indication that there will be chaos. That is not the problem. The problem is the military committed to eradicating and eliminating the threats that are within the country, that is not letting the country thrive? It is not the presence or the absence of the French forces that will determine if the country will be in peace. No. But the question is the military going to actually work towards a less chaotic country, towards the harmonization, towards securing the people and their businesses in every part of the country, not just the capital as it is currently, but every part of the country, in the north, in the south, in the central, everywhere in the country? So that is the major question.
Now, after the ejection of French troops, Mali now wants the UN peacekeepers to leave the country. Mali's foreign minister, Abdoulaye Diop, addressed the UN Security Council in June, demanding the withdrawal of UN troops in the country. Let's take a listen.
MINUSMA seems to have become a part of the problem in fueling inter-community tensions exacerbated by allegations of extreme gravity, which are extremely harmful to peace, reconciliation, and to national cohesion. This situation is begetting mistrust among the Malian population and also causing a crisis of confidence between Malian authorities and MINUSMA. In light of all the above, the Malian government asks for the withdrawal without delay of MINUSMA. However, the government does stand ready to cooperate with the United Nations.
Now, what's your take on this statement by Mali's foreign minister?
Yes, I will agree with him that there is no quantifiable factor in the presence of MINUSMA in the country for the past 10 to 12 years. So that is That is a good stance to have, to say, because I've not seen result of your presence, therefore, I would like you to withdraw all your personnel in that state. Yes, it is a sovereign state, and they are allowed to request that and do as they please. But what is important is that as this withdrawal is going on, let there be a stopgap to make sure that every other threat that might be stopping the country from evolving and growing into the country it's supposed to be is already in place, to make sure that security is the watchword to make the people be able to lead a normal life.
The new constitution of Mali stipulates that the armed and security forces participate in the economic, social, and cultural development and environmental protection of the country.
Now, do you think with the participation of the military, we shall see an end to the pillaging and looting of the country's natural resources, especially gold, by Western multinationals, particularly those from France?
Well, for me, what is just going to change is the regime of government in place. I don't think that it's going to necessarily translate into less corruption in Mali, for example. I don't think that translates into that. It's just a different regime and a different way of doing things. But to not be completely pessimistic, there is still hope that one way or another, maybe this government will be able to handle or make better the country. But I will not hold my breath, because we've had similar governments in place in Mali that did not change the rhetoric or the idea of the country, all the things that the people had to suffer. So we wait for them to show us that they are capable of handling all the aspects of the country.
Well, we shall keep you posted on the events in Mali as the country heads to its presidential elections next year. I would like to thank our guest there, Kix Shodex, a security analyst based in Lagos, for her insight. We now take a short break before our next topic on the expanding ties between Iran and Burkina Faso. Stay with us.
Iran-Burkina Faso ties expanding.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Burkina Faso is a West African country that attained global fame due to its revolutionary leader, Thomas Sankara, who remains highly regarded among Africans for his anti-imperialist stance. Now, this country is now reviving the revolutionary thoughts of the late Sankara and has expressed willingness to boost its ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran.
In June, Issa Boro, the Secretary General of the Foreign Ministry of Burkina Faso, visited Iran and said his country will soon open an embassy in Tehran. The announcement was made during a meeting with Ali Bagheri Kani, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran for Political Affairs. Iran has welcomed the plan by the West African country to open an embassy in Tehran.
To discuss the expansion of ties between Iran and Burkina Faso, we have contacted Rova Ronald. She's a research associate at the Foundation for Strategic Research in